For those of you who are not yet familiar with Judy Ann McNamara, let me give you a little bit of an introduction. It's pretty amazing. Judy Ann was born in Montreal, Quebec in 1956, and she was actually born with a severe case of pectus excavatus and other deformities that actually threatened to end her life as a small baby. And so the family resorted to various experimental operations. They had to remove her sternum, part of the thymus gland. She had to stay in a hospital under an oxygen tent for months. And obviously she survived, but with a compromised immune system, a displaced heart, and very small lungs. And but none of these adversities really put her down. She just was persistent and pushed and worked really hard, left home at the age of 16, got a degree in honors in physics and a major in biology. She went on to study microwaves and field theory. And then while she was working in the area of biomedical biophysics research, she witnessed some interesting experiments involving biophoton exchange and transmission, which sparked her to explore the entire field of quantum biology. During the same time, her health, because of the multiple operations and prolonged use of antibiotics, began to deteriorate, and she actually at this point discovered homeopathy, which gave her a new lease on life and actually a whole new area and field to explore. So by 1992, she had left her position as the vice president of a 60-employee cross-Canada research company and had actually begun practice in naturopathy with an emphasis on homeopathy. She studied primarily Unisys training at the CHQ. She was the director and teacher and a member of the board of directors of a nonprofit naturopathy school in Montreal for over a decade. She founded the International Association for Holistic Professionals and has promoted homeopathy, conscious living, and quantum understanding of living processes through conferences and lectures. In 2005, through the insistent encouragement of colleagues, clients, and other teachers, she actually founded the Montreal Institute of Classical Homeopathy, which is known as MICH. And is that pronounced MICH? Is that correct?
That's right. That's how we pronounce it.
Okay, so that's pronounced MICH. And this program offers a fully ICH, ECH, SPHQ accredited training program. And if you want more information, maybe we can get into this a little bit later, but if you want more information about the school or the work that Judy Ann McNamara is doing for the benefit of homeopathy, you can check out their website, which is www.homeopathy, H-O-M-E-O-P-A-T-H-Y, and then the word Montreal, MONTREAL.com. So again, that's www.homeopathymontreal.com. So again, thank you so much, Judy Ann. We really appreciate you joining us. And I just wanted to say, you know, I'm really glad that we're doing this interview on quantum physics and its relationship to homeopathy, because this is an area of special interest in mine. And I just want to say I really appreciate the little synopsis that you sent me earlier discussing the limitations of the work of Isaac Newton and that model for really understanding what is actually happening in homeopathy. And I want to say that this is a particular interest to me because I actually recently have done quite a bit of research looking at the work of Isaac Newton and Gottfried Wilhelm Leibniz in terms of the development of the calculus. And at least in my mind, it's very clear that Newton had a very limited understanding of the universe and really in no way reflective of the actual processes that are going on or in any way capable of describing what's actually going on in homeopathy. So for me, this is a fascinating subject. I'm really glad you joined us. And I guess to start off, The obvious question is, you know, since homeopathic remedies don't have any material substance, obviously homeopathy is like a type of energy medicine, the question that a lot of people out there have, the medical doctors, the physicists, is actually how does it work? So I'm curious, do you have from your researches some understanding of what's actually happening?
Yeah, so what I thought I would do is to bridge for everyone is start with the organon.
Oh, great.
And talk a little bit about the relationship between homeopathy and quantum physics. You know, Wenda Brewster O'Reilly, who produced the organon of the medical art, writes in her introduction that Hahnemann's approach to medicine had little to do with the worldview described by Newtonian physics of his day. It is much more closely aligned with modern post-quantum physics. Mm. So starting from there, we obviously know that. And as you say, well, how do we explain that exactly? I think the best thing is to start with the Organon. Again, the relationship between quantum physics and homeopathy is underlined by Dr. Kunsley. I guess you know Dr. Kunsley, who edited and corrected the sixth edition of the Organon. He was a private physician. I don't know if you know that he was a private physician and a follower of Krishnamurti.
Mm. Yeah, Jay Krishnamurti, the guy who was treated with in India with homeopathy.
Well, he's treated all over the world, actually, with homeopathy, but he's the sort of the spiritual leader who taught us a lot about the limitations of the thought process, wrote a lot
right.
of holistic
you're talking,
learning.
You're talking about, because there's different Krishnamurtis. You're talking about the one who was found by the Theosophical Society, is that correct?
Exactly.
Yeah, okay.
And what's interesting there is Dr. Kunsley, who was his doctor, was also good friends with Dr. David Bohm, who is also a follower of Krishnamurti. And I just mentioned that because that relationship of homeopathy to quantum physics and to the understanding of how the mind works is really a trilogy that brings all of this to life. So I just wanted to open up with that.
That's fantastic. And for people who are not familiar with David Bohm is a physicist who actually traveled around with the Dalai Lama for a period of time, and he wrote an excellent book called Wholeness and the Implicate Order. So if you're interested in more about David Bohm, you can look him up on the internet. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Okay, great. No, thanks. I appreciate that. Okay, so what I'd like to do is take the aphorism 11 from the Organon
great.
And just look at Hahnemann's exact definition of how homeopathy works, because he explained it. And look at how he explained it in his words and correlate his explanation to what we know today in quantum physics. And
great.
In that way, I thought I would introduce the concepts in quantum physics that every homeopath should know and understand. So the aphorism 11 opens with the sentence, "When a man falls ill, it is at first only the spirit-like vital force everywhere present in the organism, which is mistuned through the dynamic influence of the hostile disease agent." So that word dynamic reflects Hahnemann's understanding of both disease and the therapeutic action of homeopathy. So before we go anywhere, we have to understand what he meant by dynamic. And he provides us with an excellent explanation. He uses three examples of dynamic influence in aphorism 11. He calls it the secret invisible force by which our Earth conducts its moon around itself. He calls it the force by which the moon raises seas to flood tide. And he calls it the power of a bar magnet when it is forcibly attracts itself to a piece of iron or steel lying next to it. So what he did here was he used precise examples of two familiar fields, the gravitational field and the magnetic field, to define the idea of dynamic. And this is core to the whole understanding of homeopathy and quantum physics. So he goes on to say that a magnet's action upon the iron or steel needle is neither material nor mechanical. It is immaterial, invisible. It is a spirit-like energy that acts dynamically. And he used the words übersinnlich, or supersensible, something that is beyond the senses and far from the idea of anything mechanical or material. Now, what's interesting, I find, is that Hahnemann's definition of this dynamic action of the Earth, right, the gravitational field and the magnetic field, corresponds exactly to what modern quantum physicists like David Bohm, Edward Schrödinger, Paul Dirac defined as fields. Now, what they said is that a field, whether electromagnetic, gravitational, magnetic, is a transcendental entity never directly observable. So we come back to that supersensible idea, something that is beyond the senses, which is neither material nor mechanical, and which we can only know through the peculiar behavior of the object it affects. Now, what's interesting about a field is that the properties of a field are such that it cannot be measured directly. It is impossible to measure a field. It can only be inferred from the effect on matter and, in a way, the creation of matter, because now we know that matter is actually created by a field effect. So we come to the first and most important concept from quantum physics for the homeopath, which is the concept of a field. So David Baum, in his book on the implicate order, as you mentioned, points to that unseen, unmeasurable, underlying order or field from which all of manifestation takes place. He says that that field holds the organizing principle for all substance and entities. And anyone who is familiar with homeopathy can hear the resonance, the same kind of language that Hahnemann uses. This invisible layer, which is supersensible, which can't be measured directly, but yet can be observed or perceived through its actions. Now, an argument that a lot of people have, or some people may argue, that quantum physics applies only to subatomic particles, and this is where we come into some difficulty as well. But if one knows one's biology, in fact, field effects are not limited to some atomic particles. If we take a look at some of the most fundamental criteria for life, whether it be the manufacture of food by plants through photosynthesis, the utilization of food through the Krebs cycle, the mechanisms of nerve transmission, and especially nerve transmission through what we call the chemical synapses, we see that all of these activities can only be explained using the concepts of wave transmission and field effects. If you really read your biology, you'll see that when you get to the fine point of describing the transmission of a nerve signal, that it can only be described using field dynamics, in other words, wave equations.
Can I interject for 1 second, Judy Ann?
Sure.
I just want to make sure that the audience, because they may not be familiar with some of this terminology, so I just want to, just hoping you could clarify. So when you're saying, I think what you're saying here essentially is that a reductionistic approach which breaks things down into the constituent parts cannot explain the various biological activities. You have to look at a much larger area of activity to understand what's actually going on a local level. Is that what you're saying here?
Well, no, actually, in a way, yes, but what I'm also saying is that if you take a look at photosynthesis. Now, if you read about photosynthesis in a science textbook, you get the impression that it's all a chemical reaction.
Right.
Right? Now, and what's interesting is how it's sort of couched, and we avoid the question of how does something that is pure energy, light coming from the sun, be transformed into matter. That cannot be explained by Newtonian physics nor chemistry.
Right.
Okay, that is a totally relativistic concept, that you need E equals MC squared, you need the theory of relativity and quantum physics in order to really understand how that happens.
Right.
So what we're saying is that the production of food and then the utilization of that food, okay, so once that food, the energy is made into what we call food, and then, you know, made by plants and stored in the plants, and then we eat that food, in the Krebs cycle, the digestion and assimilation of that food and the release of the energy of that food is again a quantum reaction. So in the very basis of life, which is, you know, the creation of food and the eating of food, we need quantum physics in order to understand what's happening. And then if we
okay,
go
good.
Further, we see that the same thing applies for nerve transmission and for cellular mitosis, for division of cells.
Right. So in other words, there's a level of reality that goes beyond the physical-chemical model, which is necessary to explain these various activities.
Exactly. Now, because that level is invisible, it can't be measured, then we tend to want to ignore it.
Right.
Okay, and we just focus on what we can see, you know, what seems to be explainable in our worldview and, you know, relates to what we already have as our idea of the world in order to explain these phenomena.
Right. Okay, good.
Okay. So, yeah, so the other example, well, an interesting example, too, is cellular division. Everybody who's taken high school biology, you know, has seen pictures of mitosis, right?
Sure.
And there's the prophase, you know, where the microtubules are formed, you know, which draw the chromosomes apart in the anaphase. So you have the, you know, the, what's called the mitotic spindle. So
right.
you know, and I, you have the centromeres and then these lines, the spindles, the mitotic spindle network, right, of microtubules that goes across and forms these arcs, right, across the cell. And it's so it's that spindle and that of microtubules that it that attach to the chromosomes and then draw them apart. Now that network, if you've ever seen a picture of that, and there's pictures everywhere in a biology book, is they form exactly the same pattern, what we can even call a signature pattern, of a magnetic field.
Mm.
So what we're looking at when we're looking at cellular division is the effects of the action of a magnetic field.
Mm.
When you think of your 30 trillion cells in your body, and how many cellular divisions go on in every microsecond? If those divisions were orchestrated by something mechanical or chemical, the percentage of error would kill you within minutes.
Mm.
That kind of precision can only be orchestrated by something much more subtle than anything chemical or mechanical.
Mm.
You know, it's obvious, and that is that level. But again, that we choose to ignore. We focus on what we see as the identical chemical reactions, and
sure.
We attribute to them as if they were actually causing this to happen and orchestrating it.
Mm.
Okay, and that is where you know we still are in a Newtonian paradigm.
Mm.
To explain life, which is obviously not a mechanical process.
Mm. Very interesting. So obviously, Judy Ann, the Western medical model, the Newtonian reductionistic approach really can't explain the action of our homeopathic remedies. Are there specific quantum mechanisms that are capable of explaining the various things that are actually that we witness in homeopathy?
Yes, there are. And there's four concepts that I thought I'd introduce tonight that I think would help every homeopath be able to explain homeopathy. So this first one, obviously, is the idea of a field, right? And that's what we're talking about here, is understanding that a field is something that is it can only reveal itself through a response, right? It's multidimensional. Its mode of action, I think, most closely resembles that of a two-dimensional or three-dimensional waves or an electromagnetic wave as light. Okay, so what's a wave? Let's just start with that because understanding a wave is essential to understanding a field. If you've ever been in a boat on a lake and watched the waves formed by the boat, you know, and other boats, you know, in the water, let's say it was a calm day, then you've observed wave patterns, right, or wave interference. Now, wave motion is characterized by an upward movement called a crest and a downward part of the movement, which is called a trough or valley, right? So every wave has like a hill and a valley, right, a crest and a trough. Now, when one wave pattern meets another, so you'll have these hills and valleys, traveling hills and valleys that meet each other, right? If a crest meets a crest and a trough meets a trough, what happens is that wave amplifies. So if you're sitting in the boat, another boat comes by, and the waves meet each other in such a way that all of the hills meet the hills and the valleys meet the valleys, you actually get a much bigger wave. And that's what we call constructive interference.
Mm.
But when the waves are out of tune, in other words, when a trough meets a crest and a crest meets a trough, there is an attenuation, or what we call destructive interference, between the waves.
Hmm.
Okay, so these are, you know, the basic wave properties that if we keep this in mind as I go through the rest of the explanation, you'll see how it fills out our understanding.
Hmm.
Going back to Hahnemann, he called disease a mistunement of the organism. Now, it's interesting that he used the word mistunement, which refers to a piano. You know, every one of his examples, I'm always amazed by how precise his examples are. I mean, what a genius.
Mm, mm,
you know, the mistunement, when we think of it, how a string on a piano moves, it moves in a wave pattern. That's the vibration, right? When we hit the string with our key, there's a wave that's produced in the string. So he was referring to that string movement, that wave movement in the string. Mm. And tuning, of course, happens when we hit the C tuning fork, and only the C string will vibrate because of resonance. In other words, the waves of the tuning fork of the C note, when they hit the C string, are going to make the C string vibrate and no other one, because that C string is exactly the wavelength of the C tuning fork. So we have this idea of resonance or constructive interference versus destructive interference, but here it's a constructive interference or resonance that happens when we hit the C tuning fork and the C string vibrates. So when he says there's a mistunement, he's saying that there's a wave pattern that's causing destructive interference. Right? That there's, it's out of tune.
Sure.
There's a wave that's not fitting in with the others.
Sure.
So far, so good?
Yeah, very good. Very interesting.
Okay.
And you're explaining it very clearly, too.
Okay, great. Yeah, it's sort of hard without pictures. It's so much
easier. Yeah, no, but you're doing a great job. This is very, very, I mean, it's very, very, very clear.
Okay, great. Okay, now, according to Hahnemann again, he defines the organism as dynamic. So the disease is a mistunement and dynamic, but so is the organism. Now, if we were try to understand, well, how is that organism created, if we think of it in terms of a field, when waves are in tune with each other, when trough meets trough and crest meets crest, the waves form what we call a standing waveform. It's like a quasi-static entity. So in this constructive interference, you can create what we call the standing waveform. That's something that, in other words, it no longer moves. It almost looks like a solid thing with the crest and a trough that are just static.
Hmm.
Okay. Now, what Schrödinger, Dirac, and David Bohm all said is that all of matter is the result of an energetic interference patterns that are caused by the many waveforms generated by the underlying invisible field. So what they're describing is this invisible field, okay, which generates waves, the electromagnetic waves, the what we call the magnetic fields and gravitational fields. Those are standing waveforms or wave patterns. So matter is actually created by waves produced by the field when there is constructive interference, in other words, when one wave meets another wave and we have that standing wave pattern happening, you have a particle. Okay, and so we have a very dynamic vision of the universe. It's interesting that Hahnemann uses the word dynamic all the time, and so do quantum physicists. As David Bohm says, each autonomous and stable structure is not something independently and permanently existent, but rather a product that has been formed in the whole. The whole flowing movement, the whole flowing movement of waves that will ultimately dissolve back into this movement. So that is the quantum physicist's vision of the universe.
Mm. Mm. You know, go ahead, Julian.
No, it's okay.
No, I'm sorry. I thought you had stopped. So please continue.
Okay. Yeah. No, I was going to say that. And this vision is a very exact vision, because everything that we use every day is based on the theory of relativity. Whether it's your global positioning satellite system or your computer or when you go to the grocery store and the barcode reader is a laser, it is all of that technology, everything that we call technology today is based on the theory of relativity. If the theory of relativity wasn't true, quantum physics wasn't true, then we wouldn't even be able to use our GPS. You wouldn't be able to use a global positioning system, because we have to take into account when we set up those programs, we have to take into account the contraction of space-time due to the relative difference in speed between the satellite and the Earth. So we're not talking science fiction when we're talking
sure.
theory of relativity and quantum physics. It's part of our daily reality.
Mm.
Yeah, it is part of our daily reality, but one that we tend to ignore when we look at you know the biological reactions, right?
Sure, sure.
Yeah.
Well, you know, Judy Ann, it seems to me that this discussion is very useful for people, practitioners, or even students who are interested in going out to the general community and saying, hey, there is a scientific reason why homeopathy could work. I mean, this is not fanciful, poetic imagination. This is actually hard science. This is what the universe is built on, and these fields is the leading edge of scientific research right now. So it seems very useful from that point of view. I'm curious, though, does it help the practitioner, this type of information? Is it useful in terms of actually practicing homeopathy?
Yes, it does. If we first of all understand that all of the biological processes that are core to life and supporting the living organism are happening and being orchestrated on the level of the dynamic field of the organism, then we really have to understand that is where our prescription needs to take its effect. And I think the more solid our concept of that is and our understanding of that is, because we tend to operate still in a Newtonian paradigm. When we look at the physical body, we think in terms of tissues and organs and cells. We think in terms of the stuff.
Right.
And that isn't helpful when we're trying to apply what really is an energy medicine that is designed to work on the level of the field. So, you know, another concept, I'm talking about these standing waveforms, another concept is the hologram, which, you know, again, you go on the internet, you see really great holograms on the internet. And when you look at those holograms, what you have to keep in mind is what you're looking at is an interference pattern of waveforms. So we can now, with very, you know, it's obviously the hologram that we produce with lasers is a very simplified version of what we call reality, of the hologram that we call reality. We're using, you know, very simple two-dimensional waves instead of the multi-dimensional waves that are in a field. But it nonetheless gives us an idea that a three-dimensional object can be reproduced in time and space and in its movement, right, just by using intersecting waveforms. Now, we use intersecting waveforms, of course, using light, not ordinary light, but laser light. And this is the third concept that comes in, which is that of coherence. Now, the only difference between a laser light and your ordinary light bulb at home is that the laser light is coherent, that all of its waves move together, crest with crest, troughs with troughs. So a 100-watt incoherent light source, like a light bulb, barely lights a room, whereas a 100-watt laser light can go to the moon. So coherence makes a very big difference. So again, here we come with this idea that we can produce a clear hologram only with coherent light, only with waves that are in sync with each other. Incoherent waves or signals that are out of tune, okay, will ruin the hologram. They'll create destructive interference, a disturbance. And in a way, that's what Hahnemann's definition is referring to, isn't it? That there is a signal, there is a dynamic movement within the organism that is causing a disturbance in the synchronization of processes. It's a background noise. And this is the level that homeopathy works, right? So the mistunement is where there is a wave that is not coherent with the rest, that it is out of tune with the rest of the waves creating and orchestrating the organism. And this out of tune, this out of sync signal is what needs to be brought back into coherence. That's what needs to be assimilated into the greater movement of the whole. So, you know,
I love that image, by the way. That's a great image, Judy Ann.
Yeah, yeah. So you have that wave that sticks out, right? And when we select the homeopathic remedy, we're looking for, you know, as he said, that which has been mistuned by disease, you know, by means of an infection similar to the disease, right? We're looking for the remedy which holds that the field or signal or wave properties, which are most similar to the wave properties of the disease. In other words, the chosen similar wave pattern of the remedy carries the field characteristics of both the body's reaction to disease and the disease itself. It acts as a sort of a median frequency or a waveform to the two dissonant waveforms. And the integration of the waveform of the remedy changes the characteristics of the vital force enough to be able to integrate the disease pattern and bring a new coherency.
Very interesting.
So what we see and what we very often see after the application of remedy is not just a return to the original state, but an improved version of that original state.
Sure.
You know? And that tells us that what we call the disease, okay, that waveform is something more than just a disturbance. Now, this is a very interesting experiment of David Baum's. Is a cloud chamber. A cloud chamber is a closed chamber where there's highly charged particles. And he was observing this cloud chamber over a long period of time and realized that these particles form an organized pattern. And he was able to formulate the pattern that the particles were organizing themselves into. And at one point, he got the idea, what happens if I inject new particles into the cloud chamber? Now that they've sort of formed this pattern, what happens if I, you know, inject a whole bunch of new particles? And what he discovered is that the particles that had formed this wave pattern are initially disturbed, but eventually these new particles are assimilated into that larger pattern. And again, the chamber begins to behave as a whole. So, you know, again, this is another picture of what happens when we give a remedy. In this experiment, David Baum actually came to the conclusion that matter is encoded information. And he extracted the word form as the central theme of information. It is that which informs and makes for form. He says, and then he defines information. He says, it's not knowledge nor meaning. Its basic units are not ideas, concepts, words, numbers, molecules, or chemistry. Information is a quasi-transcendental principle or field. So what he's saying is that the field is something that informs matter, that actually causes matter to form. And when we talk about information or consciousness, it's this informing principle. And so the field is an informing principle, and it's the same informing principle that would inform then the biological organism.
Very interesting. Judy Ann, you mentioned the work of David Baum and some other people as well. If somebody wanted to just, like, maybe, you know, doesn't have a very big background in the sciences and but would like to learn more about this subject, are there certain books or titles that you could recommend that would help somebody to learn more?
Well, The Infant Order is great. Dirac and Schrodinger, I mean, they're the basic textbooks of quantum physics. But, I mean, almost anything that Schrodinger... What's interesting to see is the later writings of Schrodinger. There's also Pauling. Pauli wrote a number of books on synchronicity. What's interesting is that after the quantum physicists really understand quantum physics and understand the implications of what they're seeing, many of them turn into interesting philosophers. And,
sure.
You know, there's books on synchronicity and the implicate order and things like that, which encapture, and I think for the layperson, point to the fundamental change in paradigm that quantum physics has brought to humanity.
Judy Ann, a number of years ago, there was a fellow by the name of Rupert Sheldrake who wrote a book called The New Science of Life, The Theory of Morphogenetic Fields. And I'm curious if you're familiar with that and if that plays into your concept of fields in homeopathy and...
In a certain way, the morphogenetic field isn't the field that we're talking about.
Yeah.
In the sense that what he's trying to measure is some of the electromagnetic characteristics that might be secondary to a field movement. A field, again, can't be directly measured. So if you're taking a picture of it or through Curlian photography, then it's not really a field that you're taking a picture of. You're taking a picture of the electromagnetic wave patterns that are caused by the field. So
right.
Again, we come back to that, we have to understand that we are never going to be able to measure a field, which means that we probably will never be able to measure the field that we capture within our homeopathic remedies.
Mm-hmm.
Not directly. We'll
right.
only be able to know that there is a field in a homeopathic remedy by its effects on
right.
a healthy organism, exactly as Hahnemann said.
Right, right.
So if we stick to the strict definition of a field, as quantum physics defines it, then we understand exactly why Hahnemann was so adamant about saying the only way you're really going to understand your remedy is in approving.
Mm.
So trying to measure it and trying to would not fall into the,
right.
the understanding that's provided right now.
Right. So Judy Ann, how can we make the most of this deep quantum level that homeopathy is working on, and also in terms of practical reality, when you're doing your case taking process, are there certain elements that facilitate prescribing at this more deep level?
Well, you know what's interesting, we go back to the word misattunement, and if we go back to the understanding of a wave that sticks out from the others. Then what we need to, if we go back to our homeopathy, what we realize is that what is most characteristic about a case is something that does not compute, that isn't coherent with the rest. It sort of sticks out from the rest.
Mm.
It's illogical and it's non-synonymous, right? The genius of the case is what's truly characteristic, what's unique in the pattern of events and most characteristics. Now, why it sticks out, and I think this is might be a really helpful understanding, why I was talking about information and David Baum's explanation of form as being information, is that we can understand disease as misinformation. So it is information that hasn't been assimilated. It's a field that hasn't been assimilated. It's a wave that hasn't been assimilated, so it sticks out. And we know that in the assimilation of that field or that wave, that there's going to be an incredible increase in vitality and evolution in the individual that it happens, right? So that now what's interesting about the idea of misinformation or the idea of misinformation is that it's also the definition of stress, which we know is the basis of what 60-90% of visits to medical doctors today. You know, they're stress related issues. We know that all the diseases are related to stress. But what is stress? It's misinformation. As Dr. Gabor Mate says, stress consists of the internal alterations, visible or not, that occur when the organism perceives a threat to its existence or well-being. When perceives a threat when there is none. In other words, that the organism is being misinformed by the interpreter. We keep that in mind, that there is some misinformation happening, that it has to stick out because it's a misjudgment, because it's incoherent. So we're going to listen for words, for examples, for any kind of description coming from the client, of the patient, that sticks out, that is incoherent, that is illogical. In other words, they use a whole bunch of words and then one word that doesn't fit in as a synonym with the rest. But, you know, so that's key in our case taking, and that again fits right into the idea of the coherency. So in quantum prescribing, I guess there's, for as far as practical things in the quantum prescribing, is the state of the homeopath's mind, right, which is about perceiving something new, something that has never been before, something that doesn't fit into the logical pattern of everything else about the person. So that means that we have to, our brain has to be in an abnormal state for it, because its normal state is to fit everything into a pattern, fit everything into a pattern that it's already familiar with. This is how we find our security. This is our sense of self. This is how everything works for us, is that we look at something and we fit it into a pattern of what's already known. Now, what we have to do as homeopaths is look at something and discern or perceive exactly what it doesn't fit in the pattern. So it goes against the grain of the whole thought process. And that brings me back to Krishnamurti, who says that in order to perceive something that is new, and that's what this signal is when it comes into the organism, this disturbance is new information that the organism isn't able to assimilate. So that new information, that new energy of form, okay, can only be perceived if we stop thinking. Because the thinking process, as Krishnamurti pointed out, and we all pretty much know that, is nothing but a rehashing of the known and the past, right? And it's a movement of the past, of the known, that can't meet the unknown without imposing its own structure onto it.
Can you repeat that again, Judy Ann, just for the benefit of myself and everybody else on the call?
Sure. That thought itself is a movement of the past. Your whole when you have a thought, it's already of something that is no longer in the moment. Just the time that it takes for your sensory apparatus to pick up an event, to register it, to interpret it, and then to project the image that you call sight, or to create the signal that you call sound. Okay, the delay in that, even what you call this moment, happened a few moments ago.
Right.
And thought is based on experiences and conditioning and everything that happened in the past. And if you just look at your thoughts during the day, you'll realize that, well, 90% of them are the same all the time anyway, and probably the same thoughts that you thought yesterday. But it's a movement of the past. The thought cannot meet the present moment.
Are you saying you can't have a creative idea in the moment? I just want a clarification. Are you saying that you can't have a creative idea in the moment?
The creative idea will not... I'm saying that thought cannot make a creative idea.
Okay. All right.
Because by definition, creative means something new.
Right.
And thought cannot make anything new.
Okay.
Okay. Anything new is information... Right, is new informing, which comes from the field and can only happen in the absence of thought.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, and so whether you read Einstein or anybody else who really had insight, that's what they'll all say. It didn't come from inside my brain, it came from outside my brain.
Right.
And in a moment when my mind was still, or very, very, very focused, right? Or very coherent, like a laser. So that in itself, that attentiveness and full awareness that's focused and coherent, not distracted by thought or preconception, that full attentiveness and awareness is alive to the senses, but without interpretation. You know, that's the definition of mindfulness. And that is the focus that's needed to really hear what sticks out in the patient's descriptions. That's where we'll see when the gesture doesn't fit with the language, or when there's a word...
Right.
That doesn't, you know, that's that insight that happens right there.
Right. Very interesting. So do you suggest that the practitioner be in a fairly contemplative state when they're taking the patient's case?
Yes, basically they can't be thinking. The focus is on attentiveness, mindfulness, but without interpretation. Trying to, you know, and we have to catch our brain always doing what it always does, which is trying to fit it into what it already knows.
Right.
And so it's, you know, it's what's interesting is with that awareness, right? What we see is something that's characteristic, that's not mental, emotional, or physical. It's a level beneath all of that, right? It's the level of the hologram. My students, I guess I should use the example here. My students, were when they take cases at the center here, they're on their own. The students are filmed. Their cases are filmed as they're questioning the patients. And then I meet them afterwards for supervision. Now, what we found interesting, actually, is that we're finding that when in a group case taking, when one person is sitting in front of the client, but other people are listening, that and if they're all holding that kind of attentiveness, that it's almost like three or four lasers focused at that object. And with that coherence, they produce a hologram of the client. When I come in afterwards, it's amazing how their description of the client almost brings the person into the room. We almost have a hologram of that individual. Mm. They've touched something very whole. Now, where their focus is, and I think that's an important part of the case taking as well, is on the core of the suffering of the patient. So their job, and they know when I come in, that's going to be my question, is can you describe the core of the suffering of the client in one phrase or sentence? Because once you can do that and prove to me that that phrase or sentence encompasses all the symptoms, mental, emotional, and physical, the language and the reactions, the moments of turmoil in the client's life, then we know that we can start looking for a similimum. So it's then that, you know, knowing which rubrics to take is easy when you understand that the client so holistically on that deep level.
Right.
The rubrics, you know, come alive. And Paul Hirschfeld described it, right, as a phrase or sentence that will fit every symptom of the remedy, right?
Right,
precise
right.
statement that sums up all the remedy and encapsulates the dynamic aspect, right? So that's what we're looking for. Can we have to come to that phrase first. Once they've come to that phrase, once they've come to that understanding, then we'll start talking remedies. But before that, I don't even want to hear any kind
sure.
of idea of a remedy, you know? So it's not only
right.
just during the case-taking, but even in the case analysis, that we allow a free form, we allow just a pure perceiving until we've seen to a deep enough level.
Yeah, very interesting. You know, and this is very much the way that Hahnemann describes it in the article called The Medical Observer. I'm sure you're familiar with it, where he focuses on... Yeah, and I mean, that's a brilliant article. And, you know, boy, it certainly, in my mind, clarifies a lot of different issues that practitioners have, both, you know, new practitioners and even people who have been around for quite a while. I mean, that's just one of the most insightful, brilliant comments that Hahnemann's ever made, really. I love it. I love what you bring your understanding of physics to this whole thing. I think it's just absolutely fascinating. You know, I see that we're running short on time, and I would like to give some people an opportunity to ask you some questions as well. But before I open it up to the general audience, could you tell us just a little bit about your school, what you're doing? How can people get more information if people wanted to find out more about your studies and research into the relationship between quantum physics and homeopathy? How could they get more information? What can you tell us?
Well, I try to give conferences on a regular basis. They're usually free. They're here in Montreal. The program itself, as you said, is a recognized program. But within that is this quantum understanding. And I've written a couple of basic manuals, teaching guides that we're also developing as we go along, that the students use to base their understanding. So it's you know, one thing that I want to say here, though, is one thing that quantum physics teaches us too. The quantum physics reduces to Newtonian physics. If we take the relativistic formulas and we plug in the, you know, short distances and low speeds, the relativistic formulas and equations reduce to the Newtonian ones. You know, so it's not that we throw out our Newtonian understanding or that we throw out the physical and chemical and mechanical understanding. It's that we understand that that is a smaller picture. And we need a bigger picture in order to be able to comfortably fit all of the physical, mental, emotional symptoms and rubrics together and to see them as a whole. In other words, you have to stand back and see a bigger picture in order to see all of the parts as a whole. Otherwise, you're lost among the parts. And when we see quantum physics, anyway, so these are all the kinds of discussions that we have in class, and I think the students are actually quite challenged, because not only do they have to learn, you know, classical homeopathy, the taking of rubrics, and they also need to understand this holistic view, and you know what, they also have to make, a personal sacrifice, because what we find is that we have to let go of our beliefs and our paradigms and everything that we hold on very close to our heart, which also defines our ego and who we are. And it's hard for us to let go of our opinions and our paradigms, and yet, you know, there lies the freedom, and there lies the ability to really be there for the patient, you know.
Well, you know,
and,
I couldn't.
No, it's a great group of people. We have exciting weekends. They're all experiential. They begin seeing cases from the first day in class. I film almost all of my cases with my patients, so they see they see videos. I do cases in front of them, and then they begin the case taking process in year one as well. They begin practicing with themselves and then practicing here at the center, taking cases on their own and with my guidance, and really just practicing that holistic paradigm, if you like, and that insightful way of working. So it's an arduous training, but in a strange way, you know. I think they feel that their brains are twisted every weekend.
Well, you know, it sounds fantastic, Judy Ann, and you know, I really want to acknowledge all your efforts. I mean, I can see you put a lot of thought and time and energy into this program, and for people who want more information about the school or the work that Judy Ann is doing, again, you can check out their website. It's www.homeopathymontreal.com. And if there's a phone number that they want to contact or send an email, is there that
That's
type of information?
That's right. Yeah, I'm having a free conference and sort of open house for our next group that's going to start in September 2009. We have a conference happening on November 9th here in Montreal. It's on a Sunday at Concordia University where the courses are given. And the phone number is 514-486-2716.
Could you just repeat that one more time, Julianne?
So 514-486-2716.
Fantastic. Okay, you know, this was fantastic. Let me open it up and let some other people ask some questions. We've only got 5 minutes left, but hopefully we can make the most of it. Hold on 1 second.
Okay.
Okay, can people hear me now?
Yes.
Yes.
Good.
Yes.
Does anybody have a question for Judy Ann McNamara?
Yes, one question. Judy Ann?
Go ahead, Krishna.
Yes, I think, are you talking of that, you know, if we have without thought, without, that means sometimes you heal even without a homeopathic medicine by going to that depth where there's no thought in you and the super intelligence is there, then of course you know what's going on with your client, but at the same time you have got some other thing because you have gone that deep so that you know through and through your patient as well as you know. You have got that thing which is so pure that sometimes you heal them. And that's why these healers, sometimes they heal by just seeing the person, like paraplegias and all this, I've rather heard and also seen, getting cured. So when you go to that deep, sometimes you don't need a remedy even.
Well, that's a very good point, I think, because there's, yes, what we're saying, if we understand disease is that inability to assimilate that new form coming in, then yes, just providing the space for allowing the expression of it and that can also facilitate the assimilation of it. So, yeah, it's a very good point.
Great.
Your
other questions?
Yes.
Other questions for Judy?
Yes. Question.
Go ahead.
I have read that, for instance, mathematician Barbara Hero used sonograms to determine organ frequencies, and other people have done that to determine the frequencies of, you know, tissues or meridians and so on. Can you relate this to anything in homeopathy, or is that more of the old way of looking at things, even though
it's actually much more superficial to the level on which homeopathy responds.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, much more superficial, yeah. Anything that can be measured is already at a more superficial level.
Right, thanks.
Judy Ann?
Yeah?
This is Mary from Boston.
Hey, Mary.
Mary from Boston, hi. I had a, this is very affirming for me to hear you speak because I had a very spontaneous experience of my consciousness falling into the void. And what came out of my experience was is that there was this, I could hear this unstruck sound of Om, the A-U-M, this continuously going and creating from that form. And but the void was beyond the forms, but was spilling out of these forms. And that my experience was that we have these bodies that are continuously sounding this A-U-M. And when I studied Eastern philosophy, the A was the Brahma creator, the U, the Vishnu sustainer, and the M, the Shiva destroyer, and that this is always constantly happening in every moment in a material form.
Yes, yes, it's happening everywhere in our body at all moments.
And where we get stuck is the mind gets stuck in like in a delusion or a wound or a dissonance.
Yes.
And we have to discover that.
Yeah, so it's a challenge for an organism that is always trying to find homeostasis to find homeostasis within a very dynamic universe that is changing in every microsecond.
And that's why
the challenge of life.
Yes, and that's why meditation lets you fall back into that void beyond the mind, beyond the mind, beyond the object subject ego into that void. A pure self-realization, which is beyond dissonance, beyond space and time, and therefore beyond form.
And that's why the homeopathy doesn't, like, strike to these gender people, public. They just think it is all hocus-pocus, because they can't go to that depth.
So unfortunately, I see that it's right on the hour, and so that means that we're out of time. And Jeanne, I'm hoping that maybe you'll come back and do another one of these interviews with us in the future, because I can see that we've just touched the tip of the iceberg in terms of what you can share with us in terms of your own studies and research into homeopathy, and we'd really like to learn more from you. So maybe you'll come back in the future and do another one of these interviews with us?
Oh, it would be a great pleasure.
We would really enjoy that. Can we give Judy Ann McNair a big thank you for taking the time out of her schedule to join us today?
Thank you.
Judy Ann.
Thank you.
Thank you
so much.
Well, you're welcome.
Thank you.
It's an honor.